Good morning.
Good morning.
Twenty-eight years ago, I was catapulted into a world where discrimination and fear prevail after testing positive for HIV. One minute I was living an ordinary middle-class life, and the next I was considered a vector of disease. I was invisible by all accounts because as a woman, I was not included in the CDC's case definition of AIDS. Until 1993, HIV and AIDS was defined as something only affecting men. Our government's response was chilling. By the time President Reagan publicly said the word AIDS, over 20,000 Americans had already died. Blaming of the poor and marginalized by the government was used to create a divide between the majority and those considered a threat. My first public sharing was at a zoning hearing for a planned AIDS group home in New Hope. The neighbors were protesting it not because it was a group home, but because their neighbors would have AIDS. I remember being nervous and afraid, primarily because of the media coverage at the time. But afterwards, I felt empowered. It was my initiation into resistance. I chipped away at the HIV and AIDS stigma by speaking, protesting, and going to Congress. At public events, I received an outpouring of support and love, but being public also led to being denied services by an eye doctor, a massage therapist, and several salons. I was shunned by the pastor of my Lutheran church. I resisted, though. The death sentence of AIDS, went to grad school, got married. I'm sorry, and had family. One biological son and one son adopted through foster care. My pregnancy was followed by the Philadelphia Inquirer because I was one of the first to give birth using ACT to prevent transmission from mother to child. After the birth of my son, I decided to retreat to protect my family from discrimination based on my disease. One day I was walking my son in his stroller, and I was away from my house, and two young teens drove past my house and pointed and called out, "There's the AIDS house." So we were able to move, and for two decades, I went silent. While planning the sharing, however, my 19-year-old son requested I not publicly disclose my HIV status for fear of discrimination and harm. I was hurt, angered, and saddened by this, and felt his pain as he lamented on the possible negative outcomes of sharing my HIV status and it being known, possibly being known, in the small town that we had just moved into. It felt like 1991 and not 2019. I sat without for a bit and decided to resist the fear because living in silence does not affect change and does not lead to a positive influence. I decided to use my truth and my voice. We live in a climate of fear. The continual blaming of poor, marginalized, and immigrant communities by our government has done more than just create a divide in our country. It has manufactured a fear among a certain base that oppressed groups threaten financial and physical security. That fear is now a violent, dangerous hate. People we love and know fear that they will be the victim of that hate and fear, that hate and violence. The New York Times columnist David Leonhardt said, "It isn't very complicated. The man with the world's largest bully pulpit keeps encouraging violence and white nationalism. Political violence is slowly becoming normalized. The unthinkable and unsayable are now thinkable and sayable. Every day, new images of atrocities happening in the U.S. prevent me from looking away. Like many, my anger compounds daily and my need to fight back grows. Friday night's vigil at the Berks County Detention Center had probably one of the largest crowds so far. The resistance is growing. The crowd was asked how many were there for the first time, and about half the crowd raised their hands. The vigil leaders called on us numerous times to make some noise. We know from the AIDS epidemic that silence equals death. We need to keep turning anger and fear into action. We need to amplify oppressed voices. If silence equals death, it only makes sense that noise equals life. So, let's go forth and make some noise.
Thank you. Rebecca rides long hours in the ambulance. She's a 30-year-old emergency medical technician in Tucson, Arizona. Rebecca sees it all. She treats folks with heat-related illness like dehydration and sun poisoning, a steady flow of heroin and opioid overdoses, house fires, and violent domestic disputes are enough to break her heart on any day. You might think that after working her shift, Rebecca simply goes home to rest or out to socialize with friends. She's 30 years old. She's got a good job, money. However, many times when Rebecca's off work, she goes to volunteer with a group called No More Deaths, No Más Muertes. Their mission is to stop suffering and death in the desert. No More Deaths volunteers go out into the inhospitable, underline that word, dangerous Sonoran Desert. This is badass desert people. They go out there to provide water, food, and medical care to at-risk immigrants crossing through the desert. Often temperatures well over 100, volunteers go out amongst the giant saguaro cacti to drop jugs of water, making sure to stay clear of tarantulas and rattlesnakes. Many times they do search missions for remains of deceased folks, folks who did not make it, and nobody would have known where they stopped if the volunteers didn't go out and then call the sheriff and ask them to come out and run the DNA test. In June, I heard Rebecca speak on the witness stand at the trial of Arizona State Professor Scott Warren. Scott's a geology professor who was working in the desert, and through observation of his work with wildlife, he discovered a large flow of immigrants to the west of the area previously focused on by No More Deaths. He came back one day and said, "You guys, there's more people that way that we're not getting." So in response to that, they went out and bought a shack, like a little house with no utilities, to set up as a base of operations and work out of there. Now, most of the folks they're helping, we know, are coming up from Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico, El Salvador, fleeing deep poverty, life-threatening poverty, malnutrition, or intense, consistent violence from gangs, which in many cases are connected to narco dollars provided by the United States of America. Working to reduce suffering and death in the deserts, No More Death volunteers are in consistent tensions with the Border Patrol agents paid for by our tax dollars, paid for by my tax dollars, and you look this one up. Border Patrol has been videotaped many times pouring out the water jugs that the volunteers leave for the people crossing. Look it up. Watch that use of your tax dollars. No More Deaths volunteers like Rebecca and Scott are beacons of resistance. They embody courage, dedication, and sacrifice in the name of principles such as every human being has the right to give and receive humanitarian aid. That right cannot be taken away. If I show up having committed a triple homicide, you have a right to give me water, and I have a right to receive water. the Trump administration is pushing back on that. No, the volunteers are making resistance possible for me. They're inviting us to a vision of a new day. They're helping people to resist the pressure to follow the herd. They inspire me to move out of my comfort zone, which can be very comfortable, and sacrifice more for justice. It was an honor to be there representing the UU Service Committee with clergy from all over the country, all faith traditions deeply represented, saying we were sitting there in the what do they call it, the pews of the jury room. I'm emotional about Erica. And we said, we oppose criminalization of kindness. And what this group is doing, what you're putting him on trial for, is encouraged by the scriptures and teachings of all major faith traditions. If you put him in jail, you're going to end up having to put us in jail. This year, my witnessing of massive suffering in Tijuana, Mexico, in the Sonora Desert has dragged me back in again some of my old patterns of pain. In the past, I had jobs working with refugees and another one with prisoners and another one with gang members in Chicago, and it weighed especially on my heart. And now again, I'm feeling the ebbs and flows of sadness and anger that get pretty high. And in order to work through that secondary trauma and embrace my own power to participate in life and resistance, I've recommitted myself to spiritual practices such as this mantra: breathe in love, breathe out negative. Breathe in beauty, breathe out what I cannot control. I breathe in an image for me this summer of being out on a lake in a kayak. I breathe out my father's illness. I breathe in watching USA women's soccer team play high-skill, amazing motivation soccer. Oh, yeah, breathe that in a lot. Breathe out. 3 days ago, the patio umbrella got blown up in the air and came through the dining room window. Can't control it. Breathe in the ways in which the people of this community care for one another when we're sick, and breathe out Trump's daily vitriolic, dehumanizing messages. Resisting together in beloved community generates massive power. We experienced this on Friday with people all over the place, Berks County, downtown at lunch, at the Lovett Library, at 5, all over the country, friends and UUs and family were out protesting against these militarization, the border, the violation of people's right to apply for asylum and have a due, fair hearing. When we support each other in that, in our spiritual practices, we're empowered to resist the sadness and despair that I think so many of us can deal with. We feel connected to people like Frederick Douglass. We feel connected to people like Rebecca and Scott of No More Deaths. We feel connected to each other. Our lives grow out of their lives, and we grow together. Blessings be.
Next, we'll hear from Marjorie Winter.
Good morning. I have a very small story of resistance. This is a story about when my father, when he was 81 years old, almost got arrested standing up for what he believed in, which was the right to play chess while black. Now, he's not black, but let me back up. All through the 70s and the 80s, my father coached a chess team at Chicago Vocational High School, which is an inner-city high school on the south side of Chicago. He was very invested in that team, and He would take the kids all over the state, rent a van, and take them down to the farm communities in southern Illinois, over to the very affluent suburbs north and west of Chicago, from town to town. Let me paint a picture. My father was a little eccentric. And examples, he had wide feet, but instead of buying wide shoes, he would buy plain regular shoes and just slit them and then wrap duct tape around them. And he always had to have five pockets on his shirts. Like, they don't make five pocket shirts, so he would just like tape little handkerchiefs around so he could put. And then his kids, it was an all African American high school, and so do you remember how people dressed in the 70s and 80s with the platform shoes and the bell bottoms and the Afro picks with a little fist, you know, and they would be going to these all-white communities in southern Illinois or in the suburbs, and my dad had them march in with a chant, so they wouldn't just go in, they would be like marching in, make some noise, like Nancy said, noise is life, and the chant went, any chess players here, by the way, the chant went, knights to the center, rooks on the seventh, queen side majority, remote past pawn. I would worry, like, Daddy. I remember asking board one, Marvin Dandridge, handsome, brilliant Marvin, aren't you embarrassed? No, Feinberg is cool. He was cool. And the kids were unstoppable. They would win. They were like the 93 Bulls. I mean, they were kicking. They were winning everywhere they went. They were state champs in 74. They were state champs. They were over and over and over. These kids were state champs. Fast forward 30 years. My dad was 81. He'd retired from teaching. And there used to be a little courtyard in Chicago called Harper Court where they had built in, it was like an upscale neighborhood by the University of Chicago. And they had a courtyard with little boutiques and chichi little shops, and there were built-in chess tables in the middle. So when my dad was retired, he would go there in the evenings and play chess, and all his former students would come and play Skittles games with my dad. Well, in 2004, the Harper Court Association decided to take out the chess tables. They said that the chess players were creating a nuisance. Right? They didn't admit it was racially motivated, but it was. I remember talking to the owner of the lamp store, and she's looking out at this group of people playing chess. She goes, oh, they learned it in jail. No, Muriel. They learned it at Chicago Vocational High School. So when they decided to take out the tables, my dad decided to protest. He was excited because he thought that he would get arrested and there'd be a worldwide outcry. You know, people in Johannesburg would be marching, free Tom. Why should Nelson Mandela have all the fun? So he went down to Harper Court with a card table and a chess set and a cardboard sign that said, we shall not be moved. Well, I walked over there the day of the protest to see what was happening. It was a hot summer day, and there's this little old man sitting at this table, and nobody was paying any attention. So finally, somebody called the cops. Well, I did. Comes the time, you gotta drop the dime on Dad. So the cops came, and it turns out one of the cops had been gone to Chicago Vocational High School. So he was like, oh, it's Mr. Feinberg. And instead of arresting him, they bought him a root beer float. But what happened was the other chess players eventually found out, and then friends found out, and by that weekend there was a real protest in Harper Court. There wasn't a worldwide outcry, but my dad did get his picture in the paper with the caption, Chicago chess legend, Tom Feinberg. They didn't get the tables back, The local Barnes & Noble offered them space, but it wasn't the same. And a few years later, all of HarperCourt was torn down and a Hilton Hotel was built where it used to be. A few years later, my father passed away. We didn't have a traditional memorial service. Instead, the kids from the 1974 chess team organized a Tom Feinberg Memorial Chess Tournament in the hotel where the chess tables used to be.
Wow.
So was it a success? They didn't get the tables back, so you could say it was a failure, but I don't see it that way. It was resistance that sprang from love and justice. It was resistance that built community. So I see it as a success. Thank you.
I'm honored this morning to present Jody Hill's perspective on resistance. No, I don't want to drive. Well, do you think you can navigate? Nope, I can't see. But you had this mapped out yesterday, no? I can't remember. You do it. I am briefly stopped in my tracks as I puzzle. This is the same person who earlier this week drove 400 miles alone to our vacation spot. And she says she can't see? I step back and take a breath and begin to feel those old familiar emotions bubbling to the surface. My sister and I have just spent 4 days together, and I sense myself starting to slip and roll to avoid the wild jabs and counterpunches we have thrown over the years. I know that if a certain line is crossed, the encounter will explode with her accusations and tears. So I pick up the car keys, settle into the driver's seat, and enter our destination into the GPS. Neither of us speaks for a few miles. Then she turns to me and offers, "Oh, you're right. I did map this out. I do know how to get there." I smile inwardly, and my heart is a little lighter. To survive and maybe even enjoy this time together, I am led to listen to the wisdom of others who suggest, stop resisting and start accepting.